Former Secretary of State General Colin Powell has a new book out. It's called It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. The book is a collection of lessons learned and anecdotes drawn from his childhood in the Bronx, his military training and career, and his work under four presidential administrations. The memoir also includes Powell's candid reflections on the most controversial time in his career, the lead-up to the war in Iraq in 2003, and his presentation to the UN Security Council on evidence of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. It's a great pleasure to welcome General Colin Powell to the roundtable this morning. General, thank you very much for being with us. What a great honor and pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Give us a sense of what was the ultimate message you wanted to get out in the book.
I wanted to give a message of optimism and confidence, not only in the country, but in our young people. Always believe that you can make things better. Always believe in yourself. Always try to work with people. Be kind is a consistent theme throughout the book. In the days now when we seem to have such polarization in our society, I wanted to convey stories of getting along and how to trust people and how to work with people and how you can have an adversary, but don't turn the adversary into an enemy. And so I think it's a book designed for young people finishing school, high school or college, for older people. And there are a lot of parables in the book as well that maybe a minister or two might grab onto and give a sermon about. But these are just stories that I accumulated over the years. There's no coherence to the book, frankly. You can dial in anywhere. There are 44 chapters. Some of them are one page long. Some of them are 8 or 9 pages long. And there's no index, so you can't look up anybody. If you want to see what's in there, you got to read it. All of them have something of a kind of tongue-in-cheek title to the chapter, so you got to really sort of read the chapter to see why the title is what it is. But it's been a fun book to write, and I hope it appeals to a lot of people out in the countryside.
When you talk about one of the themes of the book being kindness and some sort of happiness in our life, why do you think that's a tough sell for many people?
I don't know that it is a tough sell. I mean, if you hang around Washington or places like that, it may seem like a very, very tough sell. But as I go around the country, and this is one of the things that inspired me to do the book, as I'm a speaker, a professional speaker, I go around the country, I talk to all sorts of audiences, and I still see people throughout the country who are optimistic, who are confident, and who want us to kind of climb on top of the problems that we have. And they want to see leadership coming from their leaders, whether it's in Albany or in Washington, D.C. or anywhere else. So I find a great deal of compassion and kindness throughout the country, people taking care of their neighbors, people taking care of returning veterans, people who are trying to raise children and raise them properly. Whereas if you just sort of follow too much of the media or certain parts of the media, you would think everything's going to the devil in a handbasket. But I don't have that view of this country, and that's not what has made us great and continues to make us great. So I wanted to try to capture that spirit and spread it around the country a little bit.
You start off the book with your 13 rules, and one of them simply is it's not as bad as it seems. It ain't as bad as you think, as you write.
Right. I mean, that was number one. And, of course, the next sentence then says, this is not a prediction. This is an attitude. In other words, I'm not telling you things are going to be better tomorrow morning. I'm just saying go to bed thinking they will be better tomorrow morning, and you'll make them better than tomorrow morning. And as a leader, if you have that attitude, your people will catch that attitude from you, and you start out the next day in a positive way, not thinking that the world is coming to an end or that you have insurmountable problems. And if you look at that rule, which is number one, and rule number 13 says, perpetual optimism is a force multiplier. That sort of is a hybrid of my military and civilian experience. Force multiplier is a military term where you're always looking for an advantage, something you can do that multiplies the power of your force. And I think perpetual optimism, always being of the view that you can make things happen, you can change things, we're going to do better, is a way of communicating with followers under you or people in general that, fellas, let's not look at the bad side of the coin. Let's always look at the positive side of the coin. We can make things better. Optimism is a better way to go through life than pessimism.
Your rules, your attitudes, how much of that came out of your upbringing and those very early days in the South Bronx?
A lot of it. I mean, my parents were immigrants. They came here with nothing but a desire to get work and to marry, which they did in New York, and then raise children. And the raising of children was the most important thing in my family. I had a lot of cousins of similar background, and our parents said to us, "We expect you to do better than us. We came here with nothing. We work in the garment industry for minimum wage. You will get an education, and you will do better, and you will meet our expectations. If you fail, we have failed." And always have a sense of shame. And always mind your manners, mind your adults, mind your teachers, and get ahead. And always think you can do better. And in my family, we had a lot of cousins who became doctors and lawyers, and every one of them finished school. I became a soldier, which was not favorably viewed by the family. Gosh, can't you become a doctor or lawyer or something? And no, I like being a soldier. And I was a good soldier, and I succeeded at my profession. And it took a while for my immigrant parents to accept that. And the other thing about it that I think has a lot to do with where I ended up and why the book is the way it is education. I got a public education in the public school system of New York City and New York State from kindergarten through CCNY, one of the great colleges of our nation. All those years, I never paid a nickel for any of it. Why? Was it socialism that created this public school system? No, it was responsible, optimistic political leaders and citizens who said, let's pay whatever it takes to educate the next generation of Americans, the next generation of New Yorkers. And so I came out of this melting pot environment with that kind of attitude, and I just continued pursuing that attitude or following that attitude for the rest of my career. Now I'm back in New York at City College of New York with a center named after me, the Colin Powell Center for Leadership and Service, which I'm very excited to be a part of. And when I left the State Department and went to visit my center and saw all of these children of immigrants and children of lower income people, I said, my God, they're just like I was 50 years ago. So I want to be a part of this.
In that being just like you, what was it that first interested you in a military career?
Well, in those days, you did what your parents told you to do, and they told me to go to college, so I went to college. I didn't have great grades coming out of high school, and I proved that that was the case with me because they didn't have great grades coming out of college either. But when I got to college, in those Soviet-era worrisome days, my mother said, study engineering. That's what you need to be doing during the Eisenhower period. And engineering didn't agree with me. And so after about 8 months on campus, and I started school at college when I was still 16, just short of my 17th birthday, what did I know what I wanted to do? And I ran into ROTC, and I ran into a group of young men who were sort of the elite of the ROTC group. They were called the Pershing Rifles. And I fell in with them, and they gave me a sense of stability. They were my family away from home. We worked hard, we trained hard, we worked and met standards that were higher than the prevailing standards in the school with respect to discipline and with respect to, you know, just getting ahead. And I fell in love with it, and that became my life's ambition, to be a soldier and to be a good soldier. As I tell many young people who now look at me as a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all of that, I said, I didn't come into the Army to become a general. I came in the Army to become a soldier. And a soldier was my life. It was my profession. And so look for that in your life, young people, that you love doing and that you do well. And that's what you should go for. And if position and money and titles and medals come along with it, fine. But if they don't, that's fine, as long as you are a soldier in your own particular profession or skill or trade, as long as you're doing the very best you can in something that you do well and that you love doing, and it gives you the ability and the means to raise a good family.
I guess it was in your autobiography you wrote that you had a fascinating, you grew up in a time of war, the tail end of World War II, the Korean War, but you would be a young kid who would study the tanks and the planes and the guns.
Exactly, but you've got a great memory. I congratulate you on it.
Thank
you. It is in there. But, you know, I was born in 1937. The war started when I was 2 years old, and it continued until I was about 8 years old. And then a couple of years of peace went by, and next thing you know, there was a Cold War beginning about 1947, 48, and then Korea in 1950. And so the first roughly 13 or 14 years of my life, we were in some state of war or Cold War. And you're right, we knew the names of all the tanks, we could identify all the fighter planes. And so I kind of grew up with that as sort of a background in my life. And so it was a natural appeal to me when I got to college, and I realized I could become part of this profession of the greatest generation and the legacy of the greatest generation, as the World War II crowd was called.
You went to Vietnam as a professional soldier. Do you have a sense of how that affected you personally and, I guess, ultimately professionally?
Yeah, I went in 1962. I arrived in the Vietnam Christmas Day, 1962, and I was part of the first wave of advisors that President Kennedy sent over there. And for a young 26-year-old captain, it was very exciting as a professional soldier to get into combat and to do a job that we saw as so important. But I also learned a lot during that first year in Vietnam about leadership and managing troops that were not mine. They were all Vietnamese soldiers. I was there with one sergeant for a year with this Vietnamese battalion. And then I came back and went to some schooling and got ready to go again in 1968. But by then, it was clear that we were not prevailing in our efforts to help the Vietnamese, both because of the strength of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and the weakness of the Saigon Army. And the country turned against the war, and our political leaders were trying to find a way to get out of the war. And so by the time of my second tour, I had learned a little bit more about my profession and politics and kind of came up with the realization that be careful what you get into because, you know, it isn't going to be as easy as you think it's going to be, and you have to try to think the problem all the way through. And then, of course, as I continued my military education, I became more and more convinced about the need to have strong political objectives before you commit force. I also became what people call the reluctant general, the guy who doesn't want to go to war quickly, and that's absolutely accurate. Do everything we can to avoid a war through diplomatic and economic and political means, but never take the military option off the table. And if the political leaders of the nation decide that military force is appropriate, then you do it well, and you do it to get a decisive outcome. You think the problem through, and you put in the force necessary to achieve a decisive outcome. And that's sort of what became the Powell Doctrine and my way of thinking about not just military things, but political things and in life.
You're right about the Powell Doctrine in the book. That was not something that you had set out to do, but sort of just got adopted, isn't it?
It you can't even say it's adopted. I mean, everybody knows that there is a Powell Doctrine, but it's in no Army manual. And the term Powell Doctrine was put on my thinking by a reporter who came to see me one day right after the first Gulf War, and it had gone reasonably well. And he said, well, I'm writing an article about the Powell Doctrine. I said, that's great. What is it? And he wrote the article. It stuck, and I've been answering questions about it ever since. But it's rather simple, classical theories of war. Have an objective, and then mass your forces to achieve that objective. And so the Powell Doctrine really goes back to Sun Tzu and Clausewitz and Secretary Weinberger and a lot of other people. But my name is associated with it, and I must say I'm flattered by it.
And another one that has stuck is the Pottery Barn Rule, which is basically if you break it, you bought it.
Yeah, I got in trouble with that one. I never said Pottery Barn Rule. It was a very prominent New York Times reporter who said that, which I will leave his name unsaid. But it turns out the Pottery Barn has no such rule, and they got annoyed about it. But I got them more publicity than they've ever had. But the bottom line of it was, and the accurate part of it was, I said to the president, okay, understand that we have to do something about Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but understand, Mr. President, that if you break it, you own it. If you take out a government, guess who becomes the government until you restore order and transfer authority back to them? And so you got to think that problem all the way through, and it has serious consequences. He agreed, and for that reason, we took the case to the United Nations to see if the UN could solve it. And it turned out that they could not solve it to our satisfaction. The president decided that military action was appropriate. And the Congress of the United States, including both New York senators and a good part of the New York delegation, agreed with that and passed in overwhelming numbers a resolution giving the president the authority to use force, and they passed that resolution in the fall of 2002.
You write in the book about February 5th, 2003, your speech to the UN regarding weapons of mass destruction. And you say in the book, most people in public life have passed through a defining experience they'd prefer to forget and to be forgotten, but won't be. So what can you do about it? How do you carry the burden? Do you look at it as a burden?
Well, it's a burden in the sense that I get asked about it almost in every interview, and sometimes people will claim or accuse me of having lied to the UN. That's a burden. And there were no lies involved. I presented the information that 16 intelligence communities coming together as the overall intelligence community, that was what they had determined was the case, that there were these weapons of mass destruction. And so I presented that case to the UN, but I presented the case after Congress had passed a resolution authorizing force 3.5 months earlier, after the president had used similar information in his speeches and the State of the Union address. Our commanders were planning action on the basis of that intelligence. Other nations agreed with us. Some nations did not agree with us. And so, nevertheless, it was my presentation that was the most vivid one and the most, frankly, it was designed to be vivid and visible because we were telling the rest of the world why we thought this was necessary. But by the time I gave that speech, the president had already decided on it. But nevertheless, a lot of fingers get pointed my way, and I have to answer the question almost every time I give an interview of any kind. And so I take responsibility for having provided have to take responsibility for providing information that at the time we all thought was accurate, but it turns out later we discovered that it was not accurate. But the intelligence community, 6 months after we had not found anything, was still saying that they believed that the judgments they made at the time were accurate.
I remember I had an interview shortly after the start of the war with Senator Robert Byrd, and he was one of the few senators, one of two, I believe, who did not vote to go to war. And I said, well, how do you feel about the others who did not vote with you? And he said, I feel that they were misled. Do you feel that you were misled in any way?
I can't say that because the information we were given and the information that the Senate and the House were given was in response to their request. And if you read that National Intelligence Estimate of 2002, which is up on the web, you can pull it down, it makes a very, very powerful and convincing case that weapons of mass destruction existed and were in Iraq and were a danger. And so I have the greatest respect for Senator Byrd, who is not with us any longer, but his opinion was different from the opinion of more than three times the number of his colleagues.
You mentioned early in our conversation about being a professional speaker and going out and talking to people. Many of the lessons that are included in this book are the lessons that you dispense upon to your audiences. You enjoy that role now, I assume.
It's great fun. I speak to all kinds of different audiences. Sometimes they are very sophisticated groups of financial experts. Other times, as it was just a few weeks ago, it was Chico's, the woman's dress retail store, and spoke to 1,000 of their employees down at their headquarters in Florida. And so every audience is a little different, varied. I sometimes speak to large motivational audiences of 10 or 15,000. And what I enjoy about it is that each one is a learning experience for me. I have to learn about the group. I have to see what they have been doing. And it keeps me in touch with so many different aspects of American society and the American economy. And it is a lot more interesting than just sitting in Washington, D.C. and just sort of focusing on a single thing.
The name of the book is It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. General Colin Powell, thank you very much for spending time with us. It's been an honor speaking with you.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. It is published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.